This is the last day of this December 2014 four-day session. And now we'll return to our text, Zen Essence, an anthology of teachings of various Chinese Zen masters. We finished up yesterday with a few selections from Zen Master Ying An, and now the next one is Zen Master Mian, M-I-A-N. The shortcut of Zen is to leave the present and directly experience the state before birth, before the division of wholeness. When you accomplish this, you are like a dragon in the water, like a tiger in the mountains. You are very clear and calm everywhere, free to enliven or kill everywhere, spontaneously able to rouse the wind and stir the grasses everywhere. You do not cling to any activity. You do not sit inactive. This may sound a little strange. The shortcut of Zen is to leave the present. But here he means to see into the mind that existed before consciousness arose. This is how we most fully are able to be in the living present, when we've seen this mind that is precedes everything. Directly experience the state before birth. It's a famous koan. What was your face before your parents gave birth to you? Before the division of wholeness. What were you before you were a man? What were you before you were a woman? What were you before you were white, before you were black? It's really, when he says leave the present, it means leave the world of time and space and see into what is beyond phenomena. This is like cutting a skein of thread and dyeing a skein of thread. When one is cut, all are cut. When one is dyed, all are dyed. From top to bottom, the whole thing is a huge door of liberation. Now the Dharma and things of the world have become one. Where is there any external thing at all to constitute an impediment? Now the Dharma and things of the world have become one. It is an illusion to think of the Dharma as some abstract thing apart from this very world and this very body that we inhabit. We see that everything, every person, every movement, every change is the Dharma. How could it not be? And then seeing the world, oneself, others that way, the whole thing, he says, is a huge door of liberation. And then the next master is a master Sha Dong. And this, he kind of picks up inadvertently where the previous one ended. He said, he starts by quoting a sutra. The scripture on infinite light says, rivers, lakes, birds, trees, and forests all invoke Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Ten directions, three worlds, all Buddhas, Bodhisattva, Mahasattvas. Nothing apart from this mind. He continues, in a moment of awareness without discrimination, great wisdom appears. This is like pouring water into the ocean, like working a bellows in the wind. Our true self is no self. Our own self is no self. Pouring water into the ocean. In a moment of awareness without discrimination. This is the function of the practice we're working on, is to lead us into the realm that is beyond discrimination, division, two-ness. It can seem impossible at times how we can ever silence this mind that gives the appearance of two-ness, an observer and an observed, a commenter and a kibitzer, subject and object, can seem impossible until all those divisions fall away. And there's just furthermore, he continues, how do you discriminate? The word Buddha is a temporary name for what cannot be seen when you look, what cannot be heard when you listen, whose place of origin and passing away cannot be found when you search. It covers form and sound, pervades sky and earth, penetrates above and below. There is no second view, no second person, no second thought. It is everywhere, in everything, not something external. This is why the single source of all awareness is called Buddha. A very famous koan in the Mumonkan, Basso, is asked, what is Buddha? And he replied, this very mind is Buddha. This. Buddha nature is formless, ultimately, but it is not apart from form. It's beyond the senses, but it's not apart from the senses. This is Buddha mind. Hakuin reminds us that Buddhas in reality have no form. Well, we see Buddhas on altars, Buddha figures. But then he says, they are given form out of our necessity. As human beings, it would be the whole understanding of Buddha or Buddha nature would be so abstract if we had no representation of this Buddha nature that is ultimately beyond all forms. So it's kind of an expedient means, a device that they came up with many, many centuries ago of representing this formless nature in this way. It doesn't change when the body deteriorates. It is always there. Here. But you still cannot use what is always there. Why? Because, as the saying goes, although gold dust is precious, when it gets in your eyes, it obstructs vision. And then he says, although Buddhahood is wonderful, if you are obsessed with it, it becomes a sickness. Well, Buddhahood is another word for enlightenment. If we make too much of it as a thing that we imagine to be apart from us, then it becomes a sickness, either before or after experiencing awakening. If we become obsessed with it beforehand, then we remain sick. And if we make a big thing of it as something apart from unenlightenment afterward, then it's also a sickness. Zen Master Yunmen meant this as well as other things when he said, even a good thing, even a precious thing, is not as good as nothing. Nothing. Not a single thing. Ultimately, what is Buddha? Nothing. What is the world of phenomena? Nothing. Not a single thing apart from any other thing. And then he quotes an early Zen master, it is not mind, not Buddha, not a thing. What is it? And then he comments, this says it all. It has brought us the diamond sword that cuts through all obsessions. Obsessions. I'm guessing that another translator might render that as attachments. Cuts through all mental attachments. Diamond is used a lot in Buddhist texts, Zen texts, because it's said that diamond can cut through anything, but is itself is so hard that nothing can cut it. could be understood as a metaphor for this teaching of shunyata, no thingness. How can you cut no thingness? And yet no thingness trumps everything, surpasses everything, everything. And then this Shatang says, again, to learn to be a Buddha, first you should break through the seeds of habit with great determination, and then be aware of cause and effect so that you fear to do wrong. You fear to do wrong. The old masters had great respect for this law of causation and the significance of it, that it's a law of nature. We cannot elude the law of causation. Everything has consequences, and that is something that affects our practice. Be aware of cause and effects that you fear to do wrong. Not fearing punitive God, but just the nature of things. That if we violate our nature, if we violate the Dharma, the Tao, then we will suffer. Not in eternal hell, but just we incur pain and suffering when we violate the way. Break through the seeds of habit with great determination. Habit, the most oppressive, the most binding of habits is the habit of dividing the world into self and other, us and them, of the habit of attaching to ideas, concepts, abstractions. And from this habit comes all kinds of painful, pain-producing reactions, emotional reactions. Transcend all mental objects. Stop all rumination. Don't let either good or bad thoughts enter into your thinking. Forget about both Buddhism and things of the world. Imagine other religions saying, forget about Christ, forget about Allah. Let go of body and mind, like letting go over a cliff. Be like space, not producing subjective thoughts of life and death or any signs of discrimination. If you have any views at all, cut them right off and don't let them continue. Views is another term that comes up a lot in Buddhist texts. I can think of it as opinions. Just let those fond opinions go. But even more basically, I think we can understand views as ways that we filter things as they are. Notions, concepts, ways that we divide reality, structure it, mentally structure it, creating frames around it. Ideas. These are all obstructions of things as they are. And then these are four short sections for each of these masters, most of them in these three or four page chapters are not suitable for reading in Taisho. But here's another one, the master Yuan Sao. The mountains, rivers, earth, grasses, trees, and forests are always emanating a subtle, precious light day and night, always emanating a subtle, precious sound, demonstrating and expounding to all people the unsurpassed ultimate truth. It is just because you miss it right where you are, or avoid it even as you face it, that you are unable to attain actual use of it. Of course, here he's talking about Buddha nature. This is why Buddhism came into being, with its many expedients and clever explanations, with temporary and true, immediate and gradual, half and full, partial and complete teachings. So these are all ways that historically the Dharma, its doctrine, has been classified in different ways. He says these are all simply means of stopping children from whining. He's saying, as previous masters had said, that ultimately this teaching we call Zen is a no teaching. Buddhism is a no religion. It's a certain overlay, a conceptual overlay that the masters placed on things as they are to make them somehow more accessible to people. Referring again to this ultimate essential mind or nature, he says it is a formless, indestructible being that has always been like a fish hidden in a spring that drums up waves and dances by itself. When you look for it in the east, it goes west. When you look for it in the south, it goes north. It can give names to everyone, but no one can give it a name. In all places and all times, it is the master of myriad forms, the teacher of myriad phenomena. It's talking here also, of course, about Mu. Recently ran across a comparison, a simile of Mu to bellows. which has nothing in it, but that functions with great power. This inconceivable door of great liberation is in everyone. It has never been blocked. It has never been defective. Buddhas and Zen masters have appeared in the world and provided expedient methods with many different devices, using illusory medicines to cure illusory illnesses. This is because your faculties are unequal. Your knowledge is unclear. You do not transcend what you see and hear as you see and hear it. And you are tumbled about endlessly in an ocean of misery by afflictions due to ignorance, by emotional views and habitual conceptions of others and self, right and wrong. Again, this phrase, expedient methods, expedient means, devices, all to enable us to work with the mind, be able to wipe clean this mind, wipe the dusts that obscure our nature. When he speaks of using illusory medicines to cure illusory illnesses, he's going to our essential nature, that ultimately there is no illness, no sickness, that each one of us is whole and complete, each one of us is this Buddha nature. But until we realize this for ourselves, then we don't feel well. We feel at odds with life. But this is a misperception on our part. It goes right back to the Buddha under the Bodhi tree, where he says, fundamentally all beings are Buddha, but because people's minds are turned upside down through delusive thinking, they fail to perceive this. Every one of us, without exception, is whole and complete, perfect. No illness, perfect. But then, because of our misperceptions, we see ourselves as lacking, incomplete. He says, the various teachings and techniques of Buddhas and Zen masters are only set forth so that you will individually step back into yourself, understand your own original mind, and see your own original nature, so that you reach a state of great rest, peace, and happiness. So all of these teachings are a way to get us from, to keep us from attaching to objects, grasping at things we see as outside ourselves, so that we may turn this light back and see this perfection that we are. Without a practice like this, we would fritter away our lives, chasing after this and that, chasing after ideals, ideas. Step back into yourself. Here's a another statement where he says, in the root and stem of your own psyche, there is an accumulation of bad habits. If you cannot see through them and act independently of them, you will unavoidably get bogged down along the way. Here again, bad habits, we can so easily think of discrete, particular bad habits like smoking or other things that cause us problems. But really, he's talking about habitual reactions, afflictions, emotional habit patterns that cause us so much pain and cause others pain. Every time we misuse the mind, every time we conduct ourselves in a way that is contrary to the Dharma, we are sowing seeds of pain. And we are, each time we do these things, we are fortifying that habit. Getting angry. Every time we get angry, we deepen that rut. We reinforce that tendency to act and react with anger. It is through practice that we get create some space so we have some freedom in how we react. That's the word, that's what karma means, action and reaction. Accumulation of bad habits, he's talking about karma. He says, Buddhist teachings are prescriptions given according to specific ailments to clear away the roots of your compulsive habits and clean out your emotional views, just so you can be free and clear, naked and clean, without problems. There is no real doctrine at all for you to chew on or squat over. If you will not believe in yourself, you pick up your baggage and go around to other people's houses looking for Zen, looking for Tao, looking for mysteries, looking for marvels, looking for Buddhas, looking for Zen masters, looking for teachers. You think this is searching for the ultimate and you make it into your religion, but this is like running blindly to the east to get something that is in the west. The more you run, the further away you are, and the more you hurry, the later you become. You just tire yourself. To what benefit in the end? Well, he may have been aiming this in particular at monks. We mentioned this earlier in Sesshin. Monks who would flee the monasteries every 3 months and go off running around, telling themselves that they're going to meet other teachers, but really who fail to see that the real teacher is within. One's nature is all the teaching you need. It seemed to have been quite a problem in ancient China, and because we see so many teachers warning about it. It's warning about grasping at what we imagine to be outside ourselves, when actually we just need to step back into ourselves. And one last entry here. The mind of people of the way is straight as a bowstring, simply because they are not burdened by ideas of others and themselves, of right and wrong, of sacred and profane, of better and worse. And they're not burdened by deception, falsehood, flattery, or deviousness. they spontaneously gain access to the substance of mind that dwells on nothing. The substance of mind that dwells on nothing. This too is another way to understand whatever the practice is that we're working on. So it's a way to keep us from dwelling on anything, but, or as the Diamond Sutra says, to arouse the mind without its abiding anywhere. The mind that dwells on nothing, no phenomenon, no idea, no concept, no object. Fundamentally, this is not another, not oneself, not ordinary, not holy, not mind, not Buddha, not a thing, not Zen, not Tao, not a mystery, not a marvel. He's taking everything away from us, every kind of grasping at any notion we have about what this is. It is only because of a moment of subjectivity and discrimination, grasping and rejecting, that so many horns are suddenly produced on your head and you are turned about by those myriad objects all the time, unable to be free and independent. A moment of subjectivity and discrimination. Moment of I. My. For people who find themselves mystified by anything that these masters talk about, you don't need to worry. It's not something you need to intellectually, conceptually understand. We have inherited this practice that will do it all, that will clarify everything for us. If we can just dive into whatever our practice is, then we come to it experientially. We don't have to intellectually understand these things. We will grow into the teachings that are presented here through this, just this persistent, committed attention to the practice. Our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.